My name's Buffalo Bill and you're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM.
What I'm about to do now is warm up the dropout, first of all, get a fair bit of heat into the dropout. I'll try my best to make sure I keep the heat away from the tube itself. Obviously, you have to transfer heat to both parts as you braise both together, but one will heat faster than the other. These tubes are very thin, and the dropouts are perhaps the only drawback on a roll-off. These dropouts are a touch on the lumpy side, so I like to get a little bit of heat in the dropouts first, and then just smooth the brass into the stays.
That's the sound of Paul Villiers, a frame builder based in Gillingham, down there just outside southeast London on the River Medway. I'm Jack Thurston, and this week on The Bike Show we're going to be hearing from a new breed of British frame builders who are part of a massive and welcome revival of interest in handmade bicycles. Years ago, the typical British frame builder would have started young, probably as an apprentice with another frame builder, and worked their way up to one day, if they were good enough, starting their own company and selling their own bikes. These days, there's no typical route into frame building, and Paul had already hit, how can I put it politely, middle age before he filed his first lug. Even so, his early life gives us some clues about his future.
The typical kid, always taking things apart, not always initially being able to put them back together, but that's experience, you learn. Rode my bike everywhere and anywhere. Learned to drive when I was about 8 or 9, which is pretty young, I suppose. I was always mucking about with the mechanical things. My dad was a very good self-taught mechanic, a truck driver. He liked nice cars, had a few nice cars. It's just what I grew up with. When he got older, he took a job as a chauffeur. So we moved from Bermondsey, where I was born and grew up, to Kensington. Over there, as you can imagine, a different breed of car. And I was lucky enough to get myself an apprenticeship at one of the garages over there. So they were originally a Lanchester dealer, which for a lot of younger guys, never heard of them. But Lanchester became Daimler, and Daimler was eventually swallowed up by Jaguar in the early 60s. So I was a Daimler and Jaguar mechanic and did my time there. I did sports car racing. I was a mechanic for a mod sports team, Formula Ford, all the way up to Formula 5000 in the early 70s. I then went on just to be a car nut petrol head myself, I suppose. And I've built many kit cars, and I've built go-karts, and I've actually, you know, from the ground up. So I was quite happy bending a tube and brazing a tube together. But then life's changed, things change, and I, due to marriage, 3 kids and other things, swanning around all over the world playing with racing cars didn't seem to fit. I had a new boss by then, so she insisted we got a bit more normal. I then went into heavy engineering, heavy plant. I worked on all the power stations, coal-fired power stations mainly, where I did a lot of boiler work, conveyor work, all sorts of stuff, really filthy, but the money was good. And eventually I ended up culminated working for Rolls-Royce on their internal combustion side on turbines, large turbines, power and steam, you know, on the power stations. After a period of time again in engineering, I hadn't been on the tools, so to speak, for 10 or 12 years. I was working for a bank in the city doing IT, such as a lot of people have gone into these days. But I was getting bored. I thought I needed a hobby, and I decided to start cycling just to get out and about, enjoy myself, and I'd always wanted a nice bike. I had a mountain bike, which a lot of people have. I then found, like most people do, that if you're not using it for its intended purpose, they can be a bit unwieldy, a bit heavy. I'm not a racer. I mean, I'm not built like a racer, but I'm not a racer. I didn't want to go racing, didn't want to do time trials, but I really wanted to go touring. And I just had an idea in my mind of very much like them old, the pictures you see in the magazines, Patterson's things, of a lovely, beautiful summer's day in England on me on a beautiful old bike with my Reynolds tubes and the carrot ice panniers and my Brooks saddle, poodling along in a country lane, perhaps stopping for the odd pint, having a pie somewhere, doing whatever you do, and it would then grow and grow and grow. Well, funny enough, it did grow and grow. So I ended up doing quite a lot of tours. I've done the coast to coast. I've been to the North France. So you do all the things as usual guys do. Bought myself a Doors Galaxy, enjoyed that, then wanted more, so I modified it. In the end, I couldn't get what I wanted from a bike that I could find in the shops. And I just thought, I'll tell you what, I'll make one. I only intended making one. One-off tourer for myself in steel. Made the frame, made the bike, took it to the painter to get it painted. He asked me what frame builder had built it, and I said, well, I did. And he was quite impressed, I'm glad to say. He introduced me to my good friend now, Ron Cooper, who took me under his wing and taught me to build. And that was it. I built one for myself because I couldn't get the bike I wanted. It was as simple as that. And then I just realised I enjoyed building them as much as I enjoyed riding them. You put a lot of hours in. I'm not perfect, but I say practice makes perfect. Like anyone that does what I do, I can control the heat a lot better than I could in the early days. I can flow the brass where I want it to go. I'm not scared when I look at the basic construction of a bike and think, oh, how do I build that? How do I build that? Because I've done it. And as I build more bikes, eventually the last bike I make should be perfect, because every bike I make seems to be better than the one before. But because I try to make it better than the one before. But I'm learning all the time. Brazing, it is a pleasurable activity. Yeah, I find 2 or 3 hours can go where you're brazing up some frames and some other stuff, and without you realising it. It's quite good, really. Yeah, it's must be Zen and the art of frame building or something. But it's quite relaxing. It's cool. I've worked on lots and lots of nice machinery and nice things in my life, and I've always had Rolls-Royce on them, or Bristol on them, or Jaguar on them, or something else. Very evocative names. And finally, it may only be a bicycle, but what I build in this shop here has got my name on it.
Is there a difference between the soul of a turbine and the soul of a bicycle frame, if we can talk in those sorts of terms?
Turbines are just metal. They're just big and noisy. They do a lot of work. They're very impressive, very powerful. But no, I think bikes, for such a simple structure that have been around quite unchanged for 100 years or more, I still think a nice bike is a nice thing, a nice item, and it's very personal. We all remember riding our bikes when we were kids. Something special about it. Whether today's computer generation will feel the same, I don't know, but I hope so. There's some very, very good frame builders in this country, and there's some good guys in the States and all over. I mean, I think we're very lucky. I think it's a good time for cycling, it's a good time for steel frames, and it's a good time for hand-built bikes.
That was frame builder Paul Villiers, and we'll be hearing more from more frame builders at the Bespoke Handmade Bicycle Show after this, by another bicycle aficionado from down on the Medway. Of course, it's Billy Childish and the Buff Medways.
Yeah.
Medway Wheelers, Billy Childish and the Buff Medways. Well, the weekend before last saw the second bespoke handmade bicycle show held in the wonderful Victorian Exhibition Hall in Bristol, just by Temple Mead Station. I went down and spoke to a handful of the new generation of frame builders about how they got their start, what they enjoy about their work, and what it takes to become a good frame builder.
I'm Tom Donohue, Donohue Bicycles. I've been going just over 2 years. And yeah, it's sort of been pretty busy 2 years, really. I used to work as a product designer. And I was designing things like perfume bottles and toys for the high street. And my heart wasn't really in it. It's just sort of design and throw away, essentially, in my eyes, tat. So I kind of bindled that off and ended up riding across Asia, across the Gobi Desert, down through China and Singapore, and I needed something to sort of occupy my mind, so I started to dream up Donohue Bicycles, and that's pretty much how I got into it. The best way for me to do it was to learn to build the frames myself and build the bicycles just one at a time, really. It is difficult and complicated, but sort of coming from a design background, I know how to sort of apply myself to something and design something and produce it, so I had a lot of transferable skills. I'd also sort of spent time around old cars. I used to help out down in an old hot rod garage. I'd build like drag cars and American sort of style hot rods and things like that. It sort of came fairly naturally to me. The big thing was designing the head badge. That was the, sort of the first step. So that was a cool one to do. And then just getting a workshop, finding a workshop space. And as soon as I had the workshop, that's when it sort of became really kind of real, I guess. And that was when it kind of all started to take shape. And
I am Ted James of Ted James Design Limited. I think I built my first frame about 3 years ago, so not very long. But since my first frame, I've been doing it every day, doing repairs and, you know, getting a lot of practice in doing repairs and trying to make a living. Not had a lot of sleep, so I'm not quite with it. Been working like crazy to get this bike together with a hub gear in the middle of the frame. So you run a drive to the hub gear and then a drive to your back wheel, and it keeps all your weight central rather than having a hub gear with all the weight in the back. The advantages with the hub gear, obviously, is you don't have derailleurs flapping around. It's all internal. It's great for all weathers. I've ridden mountain bikes and broken derailleurs all over the place to start riding BMX. But with this, I've tried to get sort of the best of everything. So, you know, best of BMX, sort of come from a fixed gear trick bike. I've adapted the frame, you know, the tyres have got bigger and bigger with the fixed gear trick bikes, and then it's ended up like a 29, a mountain bike, and it's also removable, so you can undo the brackets here and you can slide it out of the frame, and you can turn your back wheel round and run it as a fixed gear. Take your suspension forks out, rigid fork, and you've got a rigid fixed gear trick bike. Or, you know, you could go on holiday, just take your suspension forks, your hub gear and your disc brakes and swap it over, and you've got a full-on 29er hardcore mountain bike. It's all super strong with a BMX bottom bracket, so you can do anything you want on it, it's not going to break. That's why it's called the 29er. This is my mum's bike with the twin top tube straight through to the dropouts. I think they call them mixedy. Is it mixed?
Mixed, yeah.
Mixed. But this hasn't got the seat stays, which you'd normally have on a mixed. She's quite small, so she doesn't need those extra stays on the back. And I've put an integrated rack, which follows the line of the wheel. And just tried to keep it all super clean. Like the, if you look at the mudguard, way it fits, it's all bolts in with sort of hidden bolts, internal cable routing, and the stays slot into the tube with little grub screws to hold it in place. It's super neat.
I'm Ricky Feather. This is Feather Cycles. Just finished my 50th frame, which is this one here on the stand. My first frame was built in sort of August 2009. Yeah, it'll be 3 years this year, so. Just generally been into bikes all my life, pretty much. And I was a welder and fabricator, and I'd always worked with metal. It just made sense, really. If I wanted to do something that I was going to do for the rest of my life, it weren't going to be in a factory, so just that's basically it, really. Kind of put two and two together. And I kind of just practiced for a month or so, and then I got the hang of everything. Basically built my first frame with a set of bottles, you know, gas bottles, oxyacetylene torch, set of files, completely jig free, all completely eyed up to the window, you know, to get the alignment and everything. So that was it, completely self-taught. Yeah, I mean, now I can ring people up, but when I first started, you know, no one wanted to know. It was just the way it was, you know, who's Ricky Feather, no one gives a shit really. So it's just, yeah, it's good that I've got people that I can ring up now and just say, you know, what about this, and they can say yeah or no, or, you know, this is how you do it kind of thing.
I'm Jonathan Paulus, one of the partners in Paulus Kairos. We make bespoke bikes in South Wales. We launched first in Bristol last year, although we'd been building frames for about 18 months before, but we didn't launch the frames to the general public before then. And since then, things have snowballed. I'm a doctor, but I did an engineering degree about 10 years ago in motorsport engineering. And I met up with Jose, and we're both bike fanatics, and he's an engineer. And we, our passion was bikes, and we both really wanted to make the best bikes we could. We went to the show last year, very, very, you know, worried, not knowing whether people would like our bikes. We knew we did our very best, and I'm particularly fastidious about the way we produce the bikes, but we weren't sure how people would take them. But people have, we were surprised. People really do pay attention to detail. We approach it very engineering orientated, and so we, you know, when we've had finite element analysis done, we know that most bikes have a weakness at the front. But somebody like Brian Rock will know that from experience, from seeing bikes that have failed. You know, one way I would say that we differ from large sort of manufacturers is that we do concentrate on ride quality. All steel bikes will have a spring rate, which is the way they vibrate, and they will also, with a rider on, have a virtual suspension rate. Now, the older frame builders will look at a person and decide to change the tube sizes, you know, according to their experience, sort of line of sight. And maybe some of the younger frame builders will work on the engineering and get the ride. But you cannot get that ride from a mass-produced bike, because they'll all have the same spring rate. So they'll have a different suspension rate according to the weight of the rider. So you'll have a different quality of ride.
I've always been into, you know, like welding, working with metal and bikes. Years ago, I started to try and make forks, thinking about making frames, but I didn't really know enough about different tubing and things, so it's something I've been thinking about for a long time, and it's great to now be to have started doing that and sort of progressed in the way I'm doing it, and actually sort of start trying to bring some ideas I've had to life. You can always get ideas, but whether you can actually bring it into reality or not, it's a different thing.
Just getting your head around all the variables within a frame. People probably don't realise that there's a lot of different things and nothing matches up, so you have to sort of weigh up the different variables, and one thing will throw something else out, and it's just about balancing all these variables in the best possible way. So that's probably the most difficult bit about building a bike frame. And when I sort of first was doing my first few frames, I had no jigging and stuff like that, so trying to figure out ways of building a straight frame with limited jigging and tools was another sort of hard issue. Obviously now I have jigs, so I know I'm getting bang straight frames every time. And I mean, all the bikes here are either fillet brazed or bilaminate. I do build lugged frames, I just don't tend to get asked to do it, and personally I really like doing the fillet brazed frames because there's no restriction in geometries and that kind of thing. I've found when I have built lugs that I find them a little bit restrictive in ways. That's why the bilam style of construction, where you're pretty much constructing your own lugs, that's why that's good fun, and you can do some real nice things with that. So I'm really into that. I got a little bit of a name for myself for doing the town bikes, because I won last year's bespoke show with a town bike. But I really build anything. I really enjoy building everything. I mean, my background's in used to race mountain bikes and that kind of thing, so that's sort of what I grew up with, BMX as well, and I've been a bike courier and, you know, sort of ridden a lot of bikes, so I really like to sort of try my hand at everything.
I've toyed around with a ton of different methods. I like to keep things as minimal as possible, clean as possible. I just like everything to look as perfect as it can look. and that's my style, I think, is to just try and achieve perfection. I do every job that I can do myself. I do all my own polishing on the stainless. The only thing I don't do is the paint. So, but yeah, I mean, I just kind of like to toy around and try new things. And each of these bikes are completely unique to each other because not one of them's got the exact same feature. So
many different kinds of bikes with different kinds of riding. So some people, you know, want something that looks beautiful and it's really clean lines and it's going to look nice and be a joy to ride. Some people, you know, might want something that's really performs and get around problems that you might have trying to ride in a certain way with other bikes, you know, braking bikes or not being able to do these new tricks that people are doing because the bike can't do it.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, we're not doing anything new. We're trying to do a better job of previously used methods. Nothing's really brand new, but we're kind of just putting a twist on everything, I think. Putting a twist on old methods. It's just nice to see everyone being able to do something that they love for a living. Where instead of just, you know, working in a factory or in an office, they can do something that they can be proud of as well. I think it's great. This show has been the best thing that could happen for this industry, I think. It's just, yeah, just really good, really happy for everyone.
Every bike is almost so different that you can't help but have to learn something new for each frame, really. If I was just sort of putting out lug track frames or whatever, then obviously you'd just nail that down and you'd be into it. But with the nature of my bike, you know, I'll have a one-off dropout cup for a specific purpose. Or one of the bikes here has got a custom gear shifter we've produced for that. So again, you know, we had to sort of figure all that out and reverse engineer some bits on the market, and that sort of each one's can be quite a big learning curve.
The enjoyment I get from the bikes is one is doing your very best and producing a very good bike, but also it is fulfilling somebody's dream. A lot of our customers will have quite a few bikes, you know, but they want a specific bike, and spending the time with them to find exactly what they want out of the bike, it is very, very rewarding, because you feel you've produced exactly what they want.
People think, yeah, it must be amazing to build frames for a living. It is amazing if you've got the patience to not have any money for 3 years, you know. And it's hard work. It's a lot of work. You've got to build your brand. You've got to get your customers. It's not easy in the slightest.
I think you've got to take it incredibly seriously. I don't think you're going to generate a fortune from it, but you'll have a very good, enjoyable and fulfilling job if you build frames.
If you want to do it, then do it. You know, just throw yourself into it and try it. That's the only way you'll learn. I think obviously if you've got a sort of kind of natural tendencies with your hands and with sort of you're getting your head around 3D things, then that's going to be a massive help. But yeah, there's only one way to try it, and that's sort of get your hands dirty.
You heard from Tom Donohue, Ted James, Ricky Feather and Jonathan Paulus. I gather some of Tom Donohue's frames are on show in the window at Look Mum No Hands in Clerkenwell. If you're passing, they're well worth a look. And if you fancy taking up the brazing torch yourself, there's a growing number of frame building courses available if you want to get yourself started. Now, from the venerable craft of bicycle frame building, we turn our attention to the bygone days of the cycling gymkhana. This is because this coming weekend in Glasgow, a live art group called Fish and Game will be reimagining the cycling gymkhana held in Kelvin Hall Park in that city in 1901. Down the line, to talk to me a little bit more about the cycling gymkhana is artistic director of Fish and Game, Eileen McCaskill. Eileen, welcome to the bike show.
Hello, thank you very much.
So now, what's a cycling gymkhana? I never heard of such a thing.
Well, it was a very exciting event that happened during the bicycle boom, or the cycling craze of the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s. And chiefly it was an entertainment. So the idea was that it would be like a sporting event, but be more about entertainment. And part of the excitement was that women could take part in it. So the one that we found out about that happened in 1901, there was a couple of cycling groups who were involved, and there were different races. So some of the races are things like a tortoise race, or there's a great letter writing race. So in couples, one half of the couple has to race to a table, write a letter, and then the other half of the couple has to then deliver that letter to a postbox. So the idea was that it would be entertaining rather than too exciting.
And this will be all be happening on bicycles?
Yes, that's right. All happening on bicycles.
And so tell us about this weekend's event and the reimagining.
Yeah, well, we're going to restage some of the races, but I don't think they'll be quite as genteel as the ones that happened 111 years ago. So we have four races who are going to be inspired by a kind of roller derby style. So everyone will be cheering them on, and they'll be racing for that. And we've got some... There would have been live music in the original one from probably a sort of brass band, but we've got new music from a band called Zoe Van Gooey, who are based up in Glasgow. So we've got songs and we've got music and we've got this musical drill that's, well, it's quite strange. Parts of it, the people are actually riding upside down, so they're on their backs with their bicycles. So it's just exploring the different sort of shapes and things that you can do with bicycles.
It sounds like it's going to be quite a spectacle.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I think it's definitely going to be in the spirit of a fun event where you just maybe look at a bicycle in a different way. There is a bit of a history lesson as well in there. So I'll be talking about the shift from the high wheelers, the penny farthings, into the safety bicycles that we know a bit better now, and how that was really important for women to be able to ride bikes, and also it played an important role in female emancipation and the suffragette movement and things like that. So there's a little bit of history in there, but hopefully it'll just people will have a great time and enjoy thinking about the bicycle a bit differently.
And so when is it?
It's this Saturday and Sunday, and it's at 2 o'clock in Kelvin Hall. So it's just opposite the big Kelvin Grove Museum, and it's totally free. So anyone can just come along at 2 o'clock.
And do people need to get tickets in advance or just turn up and watch?
Yep, they can get tickets in advance from a venue called The Arches, who are supporting this project. And if anyone's in Glasgow, they'll know The Arches already. And it's thearches.co.uk. You can get your tickets from there, but there should be some tickets left on the door anyway.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much for joining us and good luck with the final preparations. It sounds like a brilliant event and I wish I could be there, but I'll be probably down at the, on the Friday down at the Herne Hill Velodrome, unable to make the trip up to Glasgow. But thanks for coming on the bike show.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Well, as I mentioned, it's Good Friday this Friday. Hopefully, fingers crossed, it's not going to rain. They've got a new track down at the Herne Hill Velodrome, which is supposedly a little bit more weatherproof than the old one. So if you're in London at a loose end on Good Friday, come down and watch the racing at the Velodrome. There's usually a cycle jumble down there as well as lots of nice people to hang out with. And if you see me, come and say hello. I'll wear my bike show jersey for identification purposes. That's it for the bike show this week. Next up on Resonance 104.4 FM is One Life Left with an hour of video games and more. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Well, podcast listeners, that isn't it for the bike show this week. This is an extended edition. We sometimes extend the show beyond the radio broadcast just for you. And there's a very good reason for doing so this time, because we are right in the middle of the Spring Classics, which for many people who enjoy watching cycle sport is actually the best bit of the season. And I have no better guide for an overview of the Spring Classics so far than Lionel Burney, cycling journalist for Cycling Weekly and Cycle Sport magazine. Lionel's fresh back from a long weekend reporting on the Tour of Flanders. Lionel, welcome back to the bike show. The Tour of Flanders is a very special atmosphere, isn't it? It's something that the Belgians take really seriously. Can you describe a little bit what it's like to be out there?
You feel things building up over the Thursday and Friday and Saturday before the Tour of Flanders race on the Sunday. And I took my bike and you see lots of people out there riding on the cycle paths and the canal tow paths. And then they all seem to sort of magically disappear on the Saturday, because I think they're all riding the Cyclo Sportive, which I didn't do. I went out for my own ride instead. But there really is a sense that it's a bit like FA Cup final week or Super Bowl week. Everybody is anticipating the race. The TV is, you know, full of speculation, and the minutiae of the main riders is, you know, they're picked over in tiny detail, who's feeling good, who isn't, and it just all builds up to the Sunday, the main event.
Well, we'll come to the Tour of Flanders in a moment, but let's talk about the spring classics and the monuments, as they're called. Can you just take a moment to tell me what they are and what their place is in the cyclesport calendar?
Well, the spring classics are the series of one-day bike races that typically are very long. They tend to be 200 kilometres to 250 kilometres long, single-day races. So there's not like the Tour de France, where it's a you know, multi-day, multi-week event. It's literally as pure as you can get, really. It's everybody starts off, and the first person over the line is the winner. The spring classics. Traditionally, the Milan-San Remo in Italy is the first. That's held in towards the end of March, and then the focus switches to Belgium, and we've had a kind of 10 days of kind of warm-up races towards the Tour of Flanders. So there's a series of races that are typically there. They feature the farm tracks, the cobbles roads, the short, sharp hills of the eastern part of Flanders. And then this coming weekend, we've got Paris-Roubaix, which I suppose is the granddaddy of them all. That's the race across the battered, broken, barely repaired roads of northeast France between Paris and Roubaix, which is a sort of fairly grotty suburb of Lille. But for the purposes of this race, it's sort of transformed into a kind of magical place for one Sunday in April.
Yeah, or the Grand Mummy, perhaps we should call it, with the Queen of the Classics, I think.
That's right, yes.
Get the gender right there. So what kind of rider does well in the Spring Classics as compared with the big three-week stage races like the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia?
Well, the difference is that the Spring Classics, particularly the cobbled ones, favour the powerful, perhaps a little weightier riders, because there's not quite so much emphasis on climbing long, very steep, difficult mountain passes. So it's much more about kind of the power you can put down through the pedals. So that's why riders like Tom Boonen and Fabian Cancellara, who probably sort of 85 kilos as opposed to 68 kilos, that's why they are the types of riders that will prosper, particularly in the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. Because if you're 68 kilos, you're going to just get bounced around by the cobblestones. You're not going to have that sort of that weight and that lower centre of gravity to really power on through all of those cobbled sections of road.
And they often come down to a sprint finish, don't they, which favours obviously the heavier rider who can produce that very fast burst of speed at the end of a day's racing.
Absolutely right. I mean, it's about being able to produce some kind of sprint when your legs are soft and spongy and dead from having basically been battered by cobbled roads and deadened by steep hills for the best part of sort of 6.5 hours. Producing a sprint in those circumstances is completely different to even the Tour de France sprinters like you know, Mark Cavendish, who's got that incredible speed at the end of a flat stage of the Tour de France. The difference between the two events is that there's a lot less opportunity to kind of hide in the bunch and save your energy in the Tour of Flanders, and particularly Paris-Roubaix, because basically every rider is pretty much just, you know, battering themselves. It's every man for himself at the key points of the race.
You've done some terrific writing about the Spring Classics with your colleague at Cyclesport magazine, Edward Pickering. Do you think it's fair to say that the Classics are better entertainment than the Tour?
I think they can be. I think the fact that you can sit down and watch 3 or 4 hours and you get the sense of a beginning, middle and an end. At the start of the race, everybody sets out. You've got your own idea, and all the pundits have their idea of who the favourites are likely to be. And then one by one, you see them pretty much sort of fall by the wayside or drop out of contention, or as we saw with Cancellara in the Tour of Flanders on Sunday, have a moment of terrible luck, and he was, you know, sitting on the ground with a broken collarbone. You just never know what is going to happen. And so the joy, I think, is in seeing all of that unfold and play out over the course of a long afternoon, and you do get the sense of reaching a conclusion at the end. You can see, you can watch the whole of the Tour of Flanders, see Tom Boonen's won it, and then kind of replay in your mind the key moments that built towards producing that result. Whereas the Tour de France is, in every sense, much more of a sort of endurance event. You may have days of incredible drama, but there are also some fairly sort of mundane days where you're sort of just waiting for either a time trial or a mountain stage to really shake it up. Whereas the classics, you've got all of that happening in one day.
I think it's fair to say, among cycling journalists, you've been pretty outspoken on the issue of doping. Do you think that there's a difference between the one-day events and the stage races in terms of the extent to which they've been afflicted by endemic doping?
It's a very tough question, because the demands are different, but you're right when you say that the classics haven't been blighted in quite the same way as the Tour de France, and to an extent the Giro and Vuelta a España, in that we don't look back through the history books and see, you know, for example, in the case of the Tour de France, you know, 2006, Floyd Landis won, but then was stripped of his title because of a positive doping test. You know, we don't have the same quandaries, the same kind of moral quandaries when we look back at the list of winners, certainly not in the sense that riders have been disqualified specifically for doping in that event. There are obviously, if you don't have to look too hard to see some riders who perhaps have an asterisk against their name because of conduct at other times in their career. It's really hard to sort of say the classics, because they're single day events, are not influenced or affected by doping. So I wouldn't necessarily go that far.
I mean, because the argument is put that in the stage races, it's about conserving your body's resources throughout 3 weeks, and, you know, a top up of blood or some extra red blood cells during the rest day in the middle is going to be a real help. Whereas in the one day classics, you know, you've either got it or you've not. You kind of empty your tank at the end of the day, and you're going to have a few days or week to recover. And it's not that kind of race that can be swung by a blood transfusion.
I think that's absolutely a valid point. And certainly, when you say, you know, the classics, you either have it or you haven't on any given day. And, you know, whereas the classic races are more about somebody sort of seizing the opportunity on that particular day, as you say, rather than.
Or not having a bad day, because that's what they say about the Tour and the big stage races, is the winner is the one who doesn't have a bad day, rather than the person who put in an incredible performance on that one day in that race.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, you're talking about the Tour de France being, you know, pretty much one of the most extreme sporting events on the planet, and the classics in their own way are extremely demanding. I mean, you know, in terms of a single day's effort, they are incredibly hard, and certainly you see at the end of them, you really reduce down to sort of a large handful of people who are truly in contention at the end, as we saw on Sunday. That's not to say necessarily that a well-organized and sophisticated doping regime wouldn't help, because it would. But I take your point that there's certainly no sort of direct shadow cast over the most of the single day classics.
Although I'm hearing a listener probably listening to this sort of jumping up and down saying, hang on, what about the human growth hormones and all the steroid abuse that would have given you that kind of strength and that power? That, you know, if anyone looks at that videotape of Johan Museeuw climbing alone over the wall in Gerardsbergen to win the Tour of Flanders, there's got to be suspicions in that era of that kind of doping being very effective in preparing a rider to do well in those races.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, another example that springs to mind, which I hesitate to bring up because unfortunately Frank van den Broek is no longer with us, but he in 1999 in Liège-Bastogne-Liège rode over those impossibly steep climbs in the big chain ring, and even then I think people were wondering what was going on. So yeah, I wouldn't. What I was trying to say was that there isn't the same kind of asterisk, and you know, we haven't struck through the winners of the classics in quite the same way that we have with Tour de France winners.
Or, yeah, you know, and also the anti-doping has done a better job on cracking down on certain doping agents than others.
Yeah, that's true as well. I mean, your point about the Tour de France being an event where, you know, the level has to be maintained over 3 weeks means that certain risks were taken by riders or teams to ensure that they were, you know, their endurance and wasn't dropping off over, you know, particularly over the second half of the race. Whereas there isn't that, it's not quite so necessary in the classics. As you said, it's one day. All the preparation would be done beforehand if anyone was going to be going down that route. But it's a tricky one to sort of say one way or the other whether this race is clean or that rider is clean. It's no easier with the classics than it is with any of the tours.
Okay, well, let's turn to this year's season of spring classics, and first the Milan-San Remo. First of all, can you describe the course of the race?
It starts in Milan, which is you know, one of the most glamorous cities of northern Italy, I would say. Certainly, it's sort of the fashion and business capital of Italy. And then it works its way initially south and then to the west on the coast. So basically, once it reaches the coast, it then follows the coast road all the way to San Remo, which is not a long way from the French border, sort of tucked away in the corner there. And on the way, particularly in the last 60 or 70 kilometres, the course, which is predominantly flat, but in the last 60 or 70 kilometres, it sort of juts up over these little short hills called the Capi, which are not particularly steep, not particularly long, but just steep and long enough to really sort of cause some difficulty when you've travelled the distance that they've travelled.
Because this is a very long race.
Yeah, if you add in the neutralised zone at the start, it's over 300 kilometres of cycling. So it is a long race, and the thing that makes it hard isn't necessarily just the length of the race. It's the fact that they are in that final, you know, in that final couple of hours of racing, they are really, really, you know, the speed picks up, the intensity picks up. The peloton remains very big, so it's all about fighting for position, maintaining your position at the front without necessarily being on the front, and then being strong enough to react should any attacks happen on the final climb, which is called the Poggio, which is, it's only about 4 kilometres, the summit of it is only about 4 kilometres away from the finish line. So it's always about that explosive climb and then a sort of crazy zigzagging descent down into San Remo. And it was a thrilling and fascinating finish this year.
As you alluded to, it could be a bunch sprinters finish, and I think probably if you look back over all the years, that's most often the outcome, where it's, you know, a big bunch, and whoever's got it in their legs at the end of that long ride to make it over the line will probably win by, you know, half a bike length or less. But if you want to win another way, got to attack going up that hill. Is that right? Is that using that hill, that final hill, as a sort of springboard for a sort of solo run in?
I think the thing about Milan San Remo is it kind of shows the development of professional bike racing, and it kind of reveals how much more organized and sophisticated the racing has become, and also how much better the equipment has become, because over the generations, the organizers, in order to try and prevent a bunch sprint, they've kept finding these little hills to take them over. For example, the Poggio was introduced in the late 60s, I think, and then they introduced another hill called the Cipressa in 1982. And then, not even more recently than that, within the last 8 or 9 years, they introduced La Mani, which is another of these hills, specifically with the intention of trying to disrupt the peloton and trying to basically shed some of the sprinters. Because certainly in the mid 90s, when Eric Zabel started winning, there was a fear that the race would just become no more sophisticated than a sprint finish. And I think they've restored the balance pretty well. Cavendish won in, 2009, and I mean, that was an extraordinary race. And if you were to say well, that was just a sprint finish, and I'd suggest people weren't really paying attention to what was happening in the sort of 40 kilometres before that, because it was a tooth and nail fight for Cavendish to stay with the peloton as they went over these climbs and then get himself up into the position to be able to use that sprint at the end. And this year there was an attack that went clear on the Poggio, and it was Cancellara, Vincenzo Nibali and Simon Gerrans.
Let's just deal with Cavendish first. He basically wasn't able to keep up.
This year, no. I think the thing, not that they've necessarily gone into detail about what went wrong, but I think the problem for him this year was that they had a tailwind once they'd reached the coast, and the pace that they hit Lamani at was beyond insane. The Liquigas team, which was Vincenzo Nibali's team, they really wanted to try and put particularly Cavendish, but also the other sprinters, into difficulty, and they succeeded. And Cavendish's well thought out plan to position himself in the bunch and keep himself in contention basically came to nothing, because the group split and he found himself on the wrong side of it, and despite some pretty dogged effort by his teammates, he was unable to get back up to the front. So tactically, you know, it's a little bit more sophisticated than just looking at the end and saying, well, it was or it wasn't a sprint.
So was there any fallout from what happened to Cavendish in the Sky team?
I don't think so. I think, I've heard that they perhaps might have done a little bit more work behind a moped, doing some more motor pacing work, so basically higher intensity training. But I think it's you know, tactically, you no matter how much you plan, no matter how much you prepare, no matter how much you think the race might turn out a certain way, it's not really in your hands if, you know, another team or a combination of teams try to race in a way that disrupts what would have been a pretty obvious plan to them. They would have known, everybody would have known, that if you can get rid of Cavendish over the first of those hills, it's going to be very hard for him to get back. So
do you think that other teams were ganging up on Team Sky?
Well, I think that's what bike racing is all about, isn't it? It's about people ganging up on other people. You know, if several teams have an interest in getting rid of Mark Cavendish, then absolutely no question that several teams would work together to try and put him out the back and make sure he stayed there.
And which were the teams that were doing that this time?
Liquigas certainly took the lead on that, but I mean, you know, other teams at other points in the race that had an interest in making sure that the sprinters stayed dropped were Fabian Cancellara's team, Leopard. You know, the Green Edge team wouldn't have wanted a sprint either, or if they did, they would have wanted a sprint that would suit their guy, Matt Goss, you know, who won last year's Milan-San Remo. So, you know, likewise, he'd proved he had the pedigree to get over those hills. So every team goes into a race with a strategy, but I think a common strategy was certainly, let's make sure we don't take Mark Cavendish to the finish, because if we do, he's going to win.
And so let's turn to that decisive moment. It was an attack by Nibali, right? Or Nibali, you're probably pronouncing it correctly.
Basically, the attacks went on the sort of critical stage of the Poggio. And, I mean, Nibali went, and then Cancellara looked extremely strong. And he, you know, as soon as he got away, he started driving the pace on. And Simon Gerrans, the Australian who was with Sky last year but has joined Green Edge this year, the Australian pro team, he basically got across to them. And once he got over there, the three of them were away, you know, the strategy became fairly clear.
So at what point is this happening? Let's just kind of replay this in our heads. Nibali makes an attack. Cancellara has obviously the strength to bridge across to him, and then Gerrans decides to go for it as well. And why do the others not? Are they just not able or not quick enough? Or what's the sort of time period we're talking about and the distances that people are bridging in this case?
Well, on the Poggio, in that instance and most years, the gaps look small. It looks like, you know, at no stage were those three riders more than sort of 20 seconds ahead, 30 seconds ahead of the chasing group. But because of the speed of the race, that type of gap matters a lot more, because it's going to be very, very hard to close, particularly on the descent of the Poggio, which is narrow. It's got some sharp corners, and so it makes chasing quite difficult, particularly if you're not at the front. Basically, the peloton just goes down in one long line, and there's very little opportunity for an organised, concerted chase. You're really in the hands of the first couple of guys at the head of the peloton, and if they're not going quick enough to close the gap, then nobody's going anywhere. So once they're away, they chose their moment perfectly.
But you say they didn't plot this together, did they?
No, but when somebody like Nibali attacks, then that's kind of, that's the sort of rider that you would look at and think that could be dangerous. And then when Cancellara's away, then, I would imagine Gerrans wasn't the only one who thought, this is, if we can get away, when Cancellara moves, that's the moment to move. But the problem is, not everybody is capable of doing that. So at the end of the race, it isn't just about who wants to be in the move, because everybody wants to be in the move. It's about who spots it, who reacts quick enough, who's got the legs to carry it through. And then once you're up there, you've got a fighting chance. And as we saw on the descent, Gerrans rode very smartly, because there was, there was quite a lot of criticism of his tactics in those last kilometres, because he didn't come to the front and do very much work. I think he did one turn as they were coming off the descent. But Gerrans knew that if he contributed more of his energy to helping Cancellara, then his opportunity to produce a race-winning sprint would be compromised. So it was his tactic to try and ensure that Cancellara burned his legs out by doing all of the riding on the front in order to keep them away from the peloton, who, although they didn't get close enough to cause a real concern, any hesitation could have possibly led to the move being shut down, and then we would have had a sprint finish.
They're all very much aware of the fact that if you're the one at the front of the small group of three, you're expending a considerable amount more energy than the others who are behind you, and you're going to tire yourself out, and you're not going to be in a position to win on a sprint. Yet, if you refuse to ride and say, after you, Claude, then you'll be, subsumed by the chasing pack behind. So Gerrans was sort of playing on Cancellara's certainty that he could get a podium finish, and that's better than finishing in the bunch. But almost certain, if he was going to ensure that podium finish, was going to tow the other two to the line.
You've summed it up perfectly there. I mean, the big question mark is, why did Cancellara not try to call Gerrans' bluff a bit more? And the answer to that may well have been that if Cancellara had slowed it down, he might have been vulnerable to one of Gerrans or Nibali sort of pulling a fast one and attacking him and getting that crucial gap. And if he'd lost that momentum, would he have had the legs to then get himself back up to speed, get onto the wheel, and then also produce a sprint? Because you're talking about decisions that have to be taken in a split second, and you're talking about events that are going to play out over, in that last kilometre, they're playing out in sort of a minute and 20 seconds. So an awful lot is going through everybody's mind as to what their best strategy is. I'm not entirely sure it's the point where you see the coolest, clearest thinking. But Gerrans, to my mind anyway, played it absolutely perfectly, because he did sort of stare down Cancellara. He made it seem like he was holding a pair of aces, when perhaps he only had a sort of four and a five maybe. But then once Cancellara, it was like a game of chicken. So once Cancellara blinked, Gerrans was in a position to take advantage, knowing the pair of them knowing that Nibali didn't have a sprint finish to trouble either of them. So it's watching all of that play out, and it's very easy for us at the end to say, well, why didn't Cancellara do this, and why didn't Gerrans do that? But the speed that these guys are having to make decisions, and the fatigue, not just the physical fatigue, but the mental fatigue of having sat on a bike for pushing 7 hours, all of those things come into play, and that's, to me, what makes it so fascinating.
Okay, well, moving on to the Ronde van Vlaanderen, or the Tour of Flanders. there was a whole new course this year for the race. Can you tell us what the major differences were?
The major difference was they moved the finish from Ninove, which is a town about 10 miles from another town called Gerardsbergen. And Ninove has hosted the finish of the Tour of Flanders for the last 35-plus years because of an arrangement between the, you know, the local council and the race organisers. That's how these things work. And the Tour of Flanders decided to tender for new towns to host the finish of the race, and they awarded it to Oudenaarde for this year and a number of years coming up. I think maybe it was a five-year contract, I think. So Oudenaarde is a little bit closer to the centre of the Flanders action. It's also where the Tour of Flanders Museum is. If anyone's fancying a trip, that's worth an afternoon browsing among the sort of the Tour of Flanders and general cycling memorabilia. But because the position of the finish changed, it meant that the course changed quite significantly. And for those people who have watched the Tour of Flanders over many years, they may well know of the climb called the Muur, which basically is Flemish for wall, which is in Gerardsbergen, and it's a famous and iconic place for anyone who's ridden a bike in that part of the world. The climb starts in the town, and it sort of rises up quite straight and quite steep up through the town, and then turns onto some fairly kind cobblestones, the sort that you would get in a in an attractive Belgian town centre. And then you turn right, and it suddenly gets very narrow. The road isn't open to cars. The surface is a lot rougher. The stones are bigger, and the gaps between them are larger. And then it circles round a little chapel at the top of the hill. So you kind of come up out through a little wooded area, and then into you do another right-hand turn, and then climb and circle round the Kapelmuur, as they call it, the wall chapel, before sort of plunging down the other side and back onto a main road, and then a long run in of around about 12 kilometres, so sort of 7 miles to the finish. And the reason it was so iconic was because of the type of the climb, and because it was more often than not the penultimate climb of the race. It was pretty much the point that everybody anticipated something big would happen. If the race hadn't already settled down to a sort of small enough group, this was where the big move would happen, and the crowds would be huge and enthusiastic. And so losing that from the course, as we did this year, was always going to have an effect on the character of the race. So what the organisers decided to do was to take two of the other well-known and not quite as iconic but still very attractive climbs, one called the Alda Quaramont and the other one called the Pattersberg, and they constructed a sort of circuit to go round and take in both climbs, and they did three circuits of this, so three times up both of those climbs, which changed the nature of the race. I think it made the course a lot harder, certainly in the riders' minds beforehand, because it was quite a cautious race, certainly until the last time they reached the Quaramont. And to my mind, although a couple of people who were standing out on the hills said that the atmosphere is amazing, because obviously if you're stood on a hill all afternoon and they come past once, that's one thing. But if the riders come past three times, then, you know, there's a real sort of festival feel, a lot bigger event for people who are actually watching by the roadside.
I think it had a little bit more of a feeling of a kind of criterium, or I guess the Belgian equivalent of the Kermesse type of race, where they go round and around and around. And as someone who regards himself as principally a cycle tourist, I have a feeling that if you call a race a tour of somewhere, to go on the same roads and over the same hills more than once smacks of poor navigation and you know, incompetence.
I can't disagree with you. I think that they've gone for trying to make the event more attractive to spectators who and because if you've got the race coming past three times, there's the possibility that you can sell a lot more VIP places, which is what they did. They sold, or they at least had on sale, a huge number of VIP places. And if you watched on the TV, some of the big white marquees selling beer and food and with televisions in, the one particularly at the towards the top of the Quarnamont was huge. It looked like something from Glastonbury Festival or something. But I'm with you. I think the nature of the race, the character of the race, the beauty of it was that each of those hills were their own separate challenge. They had their own separate character, and they're all, while similar, they're all quite different. You know, some were steeper and sharper, some were a bit longer. Some were open and exposed to the wind. Some are, enclosed by trees. And I just felt that it lacked something, because there was this sort of, it's a bit of a cliche, but there was a sense of deja vu the second time round and the third time round. And it didn't feel like a true Tour of Flanders to me. Now, over time, I may well get used to it. And perhaps in years to come, we'd think we'd miss the epic nature of tackling these hills multiple times. But personally, I'm with you. I think it should they should revert it back, and if they're going to climb 16 hills over the course of the afternoon, why not make it 16 different ones instead of whatever it was, 11 different ones, two of which they did three times each.
And what difference did you predict that this would have on the racing?
Well, I thought that the riders would be uncertain about how difficult that last 60, 70 kilometres would be, and that they would be a little less inclined to perhaps take risks,
Or by going on the attack solo or something like that.
The beauty of the Tour of Flanders is that the old route was that you knew exactly the layout of the last 50 kilometres. Every rider knew what the course was. They'd know if the wind's coming from this direction, they'd know which sections it would be helping and which sections it would be hindering. And so strategically, because they knew what they were confronting, people were prepared to take more risks, particularly as we saw last year when Cancellara made that amazing attack, which made you think that the race was completely dead and buried and all over. And then everybody else sort of got back on terms because they knew what they had to cope with over the remainder of the race. I just felt that the three climbs of the Quarnamont, which is long, not particularly steep, but it's 2.2 kilometres long, and it's a real, even when it's in a non-critical stage of the race, it stretches the peloton into a long line. I thought that it would just basically whittle down from sort of 150 riders to 80 riders to 20 riders, and then it would just be a fairly unsubtle process of elimination. And really, that is kind of what happened. We got Boonen, Filippo Pozzato and Alessandro Balan, they went clear together on the final climb of the Quarnamont.
And that was Balan's initiative, right?
Balan's initiative, yes, looking extremely comfortable, I have to say, when he attacked. And then Pozzato reacted, and Boonen marked Pozzato, and they rode up to the back wheel of Balan, and then on the Pattersburg, which was then the final climb, the two Italians tried to distance Boonen, but they only put a sort of bike length difference between them and him. Boonen got back onto the wheel very, very quickly after the finish. And then really the run-in was pretty much, we were just waiting for the sprint finish from that point. We knew that the group behind wasn't going to catch them, and kind of the race was done. And there wasn't the fireworks that I suspect the organisers were hoping that we would see.
But a terrific ride by Tom Boonen, playing to his own strengths and prevailing.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, his strategy is he needs to be strong enough over the cobbles and on the hills and hang in there. And if he's in a group of three or a group of 23, he has got a sprint finish that can cope with anybody in those circumstances. You know, he is the fastest sprinter of those classic type of riders, and he won the race at Havelbeck the previous week, and Gent Wevelgem as well, which are two classic races but not on the same level of the Tour of Flanders, and then he went and bagged the big one as well. So he won three races in quick succession, playing exactly to his strength.
was his victory in the Tour of Flanders an individual achievement or more of a team effort? Because he does have a very strong team around him that is really focused on winning the classics, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Boonen's team are Omega Pharma Quickstep, so they're basically an amalgamation of the two big Belgian teams from last year. So it's a sort of Belgian supergroup, if you like. A bit of a shuddering image that, but they are packed with riders who, in their own right, are, you know, would perhaps take their chances. You know, Sylvain Chavanel, the French champion, always rides well in the Tour of Flanders. It suits him perfectly. They've got a Dutch rider called Nicky Terpstra, who was very prominent and got into a little attack before the sort of final phase of the race. That Quickstep, or Omega Pharma Quickstep, as we now have to call them, they were visible all day. They chased down the early break and kept the gap at a sort of manageable 4.5 or 5 minutes rather than letting it go up to 8, 9, or 10, which might have caused consternation later in the race. They rode like a team that knew they had a very, very good chance of winning it, because they were confident in Boonen. He's got great form. He's won it, you know, won the Tour of Flanders twice before and joined a select group of riders now who've won three. But they didn't shirk their responsibilities for a moment. They were, not a particularly elegant phrase, but they, all day they were all over it.
And so now looking to next weekend, the Queen of the Classics, Paris-Roubaix, presumably Quickstep will be looking to do the double.
I think Boonen certainly will, yeah. The difficulty with Paris-Roubaix is that sort of team support does tend to melt away a bit over the last 100 kilometres, simply because there's much more of a whittling down process. The flat, long sections of very difficult cobbles make it harder for the riders to draft behind each other. So it's not so much of a team game as perhaps the Tour of Flanders is, but Boonen, he's going to be the outstanding favourite, particularly now that Cancellara obviously won't be there, because he crashed in the feed zone at the Tour of Flanders on Sunday and broke his collarbone. So it's a shame that we won't get to see those two go head to head, unless there's a very unusual race in which a group goes away early and gets a big lead and somebody from that manages to stay clear. I've got a strong suspicion that Tom Boonen will win again on Sunday.
Is there anything particularly in your mind tactically looking ahead to the race on Sunday that we should be thinking about?
I think the two things with Paris-Roubaix are always the weather. So whether it's dry or wet, and the wind, the direction of the wind is, hugely important. If it's a headwind or a tailwind, then, you know, you're talking about races of completely different complexion. Similarly, if it's wet or dry, you know, a wet Paris-Roubaix is, you know, you could whittle down the potential winners to really sort of half a dozen people. If it's dry and tailwindy and a group gets away early on, we might see a sort of a relative surprise, a bit like we did in 2007 when Stuart O'Grady was part of that amazing break that got clear. A big break of sort of 20 or 30 riders, I think it was, and the bunch behind just never got on terms, and that was it. And he was pretty much out in front two thirds of the day or more. So I think a lot will be decided by the weather. Looking at the long-ish range forecast, it looks like although it might be cooler, it's probably going to be dry. So, you know, that means there's marginally less risk of crashes, marginally less risk of punctures, but the most important aspect of the cobbles in the dry is that in the dry they're difficult, they're uncomfortable, you can still crash on them, but in the wet those stones can be, you know, they can be absolutely hazardous in the extreme, and you know, if you crash on the wet cobblestones you can lose the race in the blink of an eye.
And of course, if you want to prepare yourself for a spot of Paris-Roubaix viewing at the weekend, then a Sunday in Hell, I think somebody has, I'm not sure whether it's legally, but somebody has posted the whole of a Sunday in Hell onto YouTube. And so that's well worth a watch. Although, you know, obviously in the big screen, it's far better than on the YouTube small screen.
I mean, if you can get your hands on a DVD, even watch it at home on a TV, I mean, it's the perfect... the perfect appetizer for Paris-Roubaix. And I think in the course, although it was made, you know, in the 1970s, I think it you can learn more about bike racing and more about Paris-Roubaix by watching A Sunday in Hell than you can, you know, from pretty much anything else.
Well, anything else apart from Cycle Sport magazine, for which you will be writing race analysis?
Somebody will be writing some race analysis, yes.
Is it not you this time, Lionel?
We haven't selected our team for Sunday yet. I'm not entirely sure who is going there. So
all right.
It may well be that I'm on analysis duty, trying to piece together exactly what happened. And the thing with Paris-Roubaix is you can be watching a group of riders 1 minute and then the camera cuts away to something else. And then when the camera comes back, the group's changed and you've absolutely no idea who's gone where. So... Of all the classics, it is a bit of a whodunit mystery at times.
And we should also mention the cafe stop, or as I keep trying to lobby for it to be called, the cocktail hour. Tell us about the cafe stop.
The cafe stop is a weekly web chat with me and anyone I can persuade to come along and answer a few questions. We've reverted back to our cafe stop lunchtime. So we've gone back to a 1 p.m. start on a Monday, and today's guest was Daniel Freeb, who writes for Pro Cycling Magazine and who has just brought out a rather fine biography of Eddie Merckx, who obviously won all of the races we've been talking about, most of them multiple times. So he was a very lively and engaging guest today, and people can log on and ask pretty much anything they like within reason, and I will I will answer anything that isn't libelous or offensive.
So that's a text-based web chat, right? Yeah. And the entire verbatim record of it is put online afterwards if you happen to have missed it because you're at work or enjoying your 2 martini lunch.
It is. It's on my website, which is lionelburney.com, and it's in the blog section. And I try to make sure that it reads sensibly and logically for anyone who's not able to join us live, so that hopefully people find it interesting to read after the event.
I can vouch for that.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Lionel. What have you got lined up for the coming months? Obviously, you're in the middle of your People's Grand Tour. You don't have rest days in the People's Grand Tour, do you? It's a tough one where you've got to have your transfusions and all that.
I actually had a rest day today.
Oh.
I'll be back in the saddle again tomorrow. But other than that, I'm busy writing a book project, which I can't say too much about at the moment. But hopefully, it will be of some interest to your.
Well, come on the bike show to tell us about it when you're ready to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lionel. Good night.
Good night.